Thank you. Good morning. My name is Joseph Huff. My registration number is 34384. And I represent Mr. Banks. I want to be clear just right at the beginning so we're all on the same page. So I'm going to start off by talking about three things. First of all, my argument is twofold. Number one, Guatney and the Fifth Amendment and Rooch apply to this situation. But even if this court finds that it does not apply to this situation because it's a post-conviction appeal we're talking about as opposed to direct, even if this doesn't apply, the prosecution here failed to show that my client willfully and unreasonably failed to comply with probation. And number three, the only remedy we're asking for today is that this court remand the case back and allow Mr. Banks, now that his 35C appeal is completed, to participate in probation like he intends to do. So first of all, why does Guatney and the Fifth Amendment and Rooch apply to this case? And I'll be quite upfront. Rooch said, we are specifically not applying this or not deciding whether this applies to post-conviction appeals. But I would argue that the reasoning that underlines Rooch and Guatney and the Fifth Amendment and Murphy applies in this case, and I'll tell you what that is. The Fifth Amendment applies, according to Guatney, when there is a risk of having the original charges reinstated, when a client's admission to a therapist could be used against him in a subsequent trial, when he could face charges of perjury, and according to Murphy, absent a grant of use immunity by the prosecution may not revoke probation. So I would argue that those four principles, even though not strictly applied in Guatney or Rooch to post-conviction appeals, those still resound in this case. Those fears are still ever present in Mr. Banks' case. Yes, sir.
Counsel, good morning.
Good morning.
Can I read those cases and line them up against this case? What flashes at me is that in those cases, not only was there a direct appeal going on, but those defendants never pled guilty. And here we have a defendant who did plead guilty. Can you, first of all, is that correct? And isn't that a huge difference?
I can't say if that's correct or not because I don't know, but assuming that it is, I don't think it's a big difference because whether or not a client has pled guilty, he still has appellate remedies, even direct appellate remedies, as in addition to 35C and other post-conviction remedies. And I don't know that Guatney or Rooch or Murphy made that a distinction. In other words, I don't know that any of those cases said, those might have been the facts of those three cases, but I can't say that any of them said this only applies to people who went to trial and were convicted as opposed to guilty pleas.
Well, for instance, if he had prevailed in his post-conviction and the case had gone back for a retrial, the prosecution would get to present to the jury that he had pled guilty to sexual assault, wouldn't they?
You know, Your Honor, I'm not sure that they would, actually. I can't say I'm prepared to answer that. I don't know of any cases directly on point, but my understanding is that they would not be allowed to do that. I mean, I think that would be overly prejudicial as opposed to probative. Perhaps they would. Perhaps if he had given an interview with a probation officer in a pre-sentence investigation report, that would be admissible. But the fact that he actually pled guilty and then was allowed to withdraw his plea, those are based on constitutional grounds. And when you find a constitutional violation such as that, for instance, that his counsel was ineffective, I'm pretty sure that the case law is you can't then use that against someone. I'm not sure, but
no,
that's
I'm not
just
sure either. And I'll ask your counterpart his thoughts on that when it comes up. The point there being, in part, that nobody forced him to plead guilty to sexual assault. That's something that he made a decision on. And with the post-conviction cases out of the way now, there was nothing improper in terms of ineffective assistance of counsel or anything either, apparently. That was his decision to plead guilty.
That is correct. This court did not review his 35C appeal, which we lost a couple months ago. But I would say that I don't really see that that factors in the analysis, because the three main things that Watney was concerned with is that admissions to a therapist could be used against you at trial, it could be a basis for perjury, and basically there was no grant of immunity here. And all we're asking for, again, is that this be remanded for Mr. Banks to actually complete his probation. If you look at the record, he was more than willing to comply with probation. They basically just booted him out. They said, if you're not going to talk about the offense at issue, then you can't do this. But now that his direct appeal is over, his 35C appeal is over, he would absolutely comply at this point and talk about the facts of the offense. If he denied, which he might do because he does maintain his innocence even though he did plead guilty, they would give him 90 days to denial, and then they would refer him to a polygraph examination and a deniers group, which is statutory. They didn't even give him those options in this case. And that's also part of my argument, is that he wasn't afforded the statutory options that he should have been afforded. Even if Watney doesn't apply, even if the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply, even putting aside the fact that I'm arguing that they didn't prove that he unreasonably and unwillfully violated probation, they still didn't comply with the statute and allow him 90 days in deniers group, or refer him to a polygraph examination, or refer him to a deniers group. They just immediately said, well, you can't do probation, and they took him into custody because he maintained that he was on appeal and he didn't want to talk about the instant offense. I can see why this court would be hesitant to extend this to post-conviction appeals, because you're probably worried about opening the floodgates. But I would assure this court that people getting probation in these sorts of cases is exceedingly rare. And generally, those who plead guilty and get probation stick with the probation. They don't appeal it, because probation is generally considered a sweetheart deal. So I don't think this court would open the floodgates by extending this to post-conviction 35C.
Well, Mr. Huff, I don't think the issue really, is, to me at least, is not opening the floodgates as much as there's no deadline. It will surprise you not at all, I'm sure, to know we see post-conviction motions, successive motions, you know, for 10 years. So that's, to me, that's more of a concern, and the Attorney General has raised that. There's no deadline here. It's forever that he can deny, because you can always have a post-conviction motion.
Well, let me address that. Number one, that's not Mr. Banks' fault that the appellate process takes as long as it does.
No, but it would be, and it's not him, but in another case, take the hypothetical case where the defendant files seriatim post-conviction motions, you know, there are many, we got a lot of frequent flyers around here where there are, you know, You always have an appeal pending.
Oh, I see them, Your Honor.
I know you do.
But let me say this. They could modify their treatment program to encompass those sorts of situations. There's no reason why they couldn't have accepted Mr. Banks into probation, even with the fact that he won't talk about the instant offense. I know that that's part of therapy generally, and I know that that's part of their program, but can't they find a policy, a way to treat people in the interim? I would say absolutely. And that's why the legislature has made that 90-day period for deniers. That's why the legislature's provided for referral to a polygraph. That's why the legislature has said that they can be referred to a deniers group. There are ways, there are procedures that could be in place to encompass these very rare situations. And I agree, this could go on and on and on. In this particular case, it won't. It's over. If this court remands this back today for him to start probation, he will start probation. He has no more grounds to claim Fifth Amendment as far as the state courts are concerned. And believe me, speaking to him, he would start probation today if he could.
Can I ask you another question, Mr. Huff?
Yes, sir.
And as you know, this panel did not see the appeal on the 35C. Did you handle that?
Yes, I did.
All right. Well, I presume from what I see here that he was seeking to undo the plea. Is that correct?
He was, based on ineffective assistance of counsel. He wanted his plea withdrawn, and he wanted to have a jury trial.
Okay, thank you.
So let me get to the second point while I have some time here, and that is that even if this court finds that the Fifth Amendment, Wotton and Rich, do not apply to 35C appeals or post-conviction appeals, the state still failed to show that Mr. Banks unreasonably and willfully violated his probation. And that standard comes out of Strickland. And the reason I say that is because everybody who took the stand, the probation officer, the director of the THE, said he didn't refuse to participate. He never refused to participate in the program. And the court even found he consented to offense-specific treatment. The only thing he failed to do was discuss the facts of the instant case, and he invoked his Fifth Amendment right pursuant to an attorney's advice. And I think that that's critical, that he did this pursuant to an attorney's advice. The attorney, whoever gave him the advice, it wasn't me, it was the trial attorney below, but I believe that they were relying on Watney at that time to say, look, you have a Fifth Amendment right. I don't think under those circumstances you can say that he willfully and unreasonably failed to comply with probation when your own attorney tells you there's case law out there that allows you to invoke the Fifth Amendment. Maybe the attorney misread it. Maybe the attorney thought that it would extend to post-conviction, and this court says it wouldn't. But it's a reasonable mistake on the attorney's part, if that's the case. And it's reasonable for Mr. Banks to proceed pursuant to that advice.
Well, did Mr. Banks raise that issue in the post-conviction court and ask the post-conviction court to take a look at what the advice was, whether it was appropriate or not? You know, I don't recall seeing anything like that.
I just recall seeing that it was represented that he did all of this pursuant to an attorney's advice. It wasn't just him going out on his own. I don't think that that was explained very thoroughly below, but I think the record stands. The prosecution didn't introduce any evidence that it wasn't pursuant to an attorney's advice.
Well, even if it was pursuant to an attorney's advice, wouldn't it be willful in the sense of being, yes, I'm doing it because I was told I could do it and I should do it? I mean,
but he didn't set out to not comply with probation. He set out to comply with probation. It's the probation department that wouldn't allow him to proceed because he was acting pursuant to an attorney's advice, invoking the Fifth, which is a reasonable reading from Watney and Murphy, that he could have done as much.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
That may reveal some ignorance on my part, and I apologize. I always had the impression this willfulness standard was limited by the case law to ability to pay. I could be dead wrong about that. Could you help me with that? You're a willful violation.
I know that it does apply to that, inability to pay situations. I can't say I had any case law right off the top of my head that would apply to other situations. I've argued it repeatedly, not that this court has ever accepted it, but even if you put aside that willful...
I appreciate your tenacity.
Even if you put aside that willful standard, just look at the testimony at the revocation hearing and you will see that he didn't violate his probation because he never refused to participate. That's according to Gilmore, the director. He only refused to admit to the facts of the instant case. And the court found, and I think this court is somewhat bound by this factual determination, the court found that he indeed consented to offense-specific treatment. They wouldn't allow him to participate in the treatment, but he attempted or tried to participate in the treatment. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ethan Zwei, registration number 44794, and I'm here today on behalf of the people. I'd like to start out with just by saying opposing counsel today has represented that Mr. Banks is again promising, if this case is remanded for him to go back on probation, that he will comply with the conditions of his probation. That is the same thing he did over a decade ago, when he pled guilty and was granted a deferred judgment, it is the same exact thing that he did at the sentencing where he was granted probation. He essentially begged the trial court for probation and repeatedly stated that he was a sex offender and that he understood what was required to stay on probation. And I think he said something to the effect of, I want to emphasize that I understand what it will take to remain on probation. Given all that, he was revoked from probation for refusing to become a client of the treatment provider.
Well, he refused to sign a form on the advice of counsel because he had an appeal pending that if he won would have gotten him a new trial. So let me ask you directly, and this is a concern I have about your position here, why shouldn't Watney and Rook apply in this case? Because we have the same situation. If he won his 35C, he'd get a new trial. And if he had confessed that he had committed this sex assault, then he's dead on his new trial. Why shouldn't a defendant who has an appeal pending be entitled to say, I want to cooperate, but I can't talk about the facts of this case while my appeal is pending? What's wrong with that?
First, I think it's our position that Watney and Roosh are incorrect. Second,
did you even argue that in your brief? I don't remember that.
I did not argue that in the brief. Second, the circumstances here are fundamentally different, especially on post-conviction. I think from a starting point, Mr. Banks' conviction is considered final since his direct appeal is exhausted. And it's presumed valid. In the cases where the direct appeal is pending, that is not the case. With respect just to the specifics of this case, in Roosh and Guatney, there were both, those cases went to trial. In Guatney testified at the trial and denied the crime. In this case, Mr. Banks pleaded guilty. The form that he was required to, or the entry form, the consent to treatment, he only had to acknowledge that he was a sex offender. He had pleaded guilty at the hearing where he was granted probation. He repeatedly acknowledged he was a sex offender. There was no risk of self-incrimination at the time he refused to become a client of the treatment provider.
I'll ask you the question that I asked your counterpart, and I gave you some advance notice then. In the 35C post-conviction setting, which would go to a retrial, on the retrial, would the people be able to get into evidence that he had pled guilty?
I appreciate the advance notice, and I, like opposing counsel, I do not know the answer to that question, so I apologize, even with the advance notice.
Okay.
I'm just not sure, and I wouldn't feel comfortable giving an answer to that question. Like I said, though, at the time he refused to become a client, there was no danger of self-incrimination, I think. That is unlike Roosh and Watney.
Well, help me understand that, Mr. Zweigen. I'm sorry if I'm just being thick here. Why wouldn't there be a risk of self-incrimination? Again, let's take the scenario that he wins the appeal. He gets to a new trial. And now he goes to a new trial. He chooses not to testify. Why isn't it, had he confessed to the psychiatrist or whoever else, would be admissible against him? You know, I understand your argument, the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply here, but that would be admissible against him in that trial. Yeah, they would put that, if I'm the DA, I put on the psychiatrist. He confessed that he committed this act in this case. Why should he have to do that while his appeal is pending?
I think what's different in this case is when he was sentenced for probation, he repeatedly admitted that he was acknowledged that he was a sex offender. So at the time
at the probation hearing we're talking about, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well.
At the sentencing after his deferred was revoked and when the court granted probation subsequent to the Mr. Banks repeatedly he said, I acknowledge I'm a sex offender. I know what it's going to take to remain on probation. And I'm telling you that I will abide by those conditions. The fact that he then would not restate that at the, I guess my point is, he can't re-incriminate himself. He's already stated.
No, but we're assuming here that that would all be admissible, which is the question that neither of you really, I'm not digging on either. You don't know. We don't know whether that would have been admissible.
True.
Well, his statements at the hearing.
Right, right.
I guess that's correct.
Because if they're not admissible, again, just take a hypothetical, I don't know the answer either, but if they're not admissible, you know, then he's got a problem, had he conceded. I mean, your argument assumes that all this would come in anyway, so no harm, no foul. If you're right, you understand that. If you're wrong, that it's admissible, it's a different case, isn't it?
Well, I think at the time that he was posed, he was asked to sign the paperwork. He was asked to acknowledge that he was a sex offender. Whether he was going to be asked questions later, I think, would be a premature invocation of his Fifth Amendment right. He can't prospectively invoke his Fifth Amendment right. At the time he was posed the question, or, you know, I acknowledge I'm a sex offender, at that time there was no danger of self-incrimination. And as the trial court noted that, there's no Fifth Amendment privilege that Mr. Banks had at the time he declined to answer questions in this particular matter as put to him by the treatment provider.
But I guess I'm trying to draw a distinction with you between the Fifth Amendment and just generally, you know, conceding something that could get used against him. That line is a little fine, but, you know, I think that's where we are. I mean, at the time he was asked to sign that form, there was a possibility that he was going to get a new trial. And if he had signed that form and conceded he was a sex offender, had he won his appeal, he has a new trial, you know, that's going to come in against him. I mean, that feels like self-incrimination to me, but, you know, I'm pushed back.
I think there's a real question as to whether that form would come in against him at a new trial. And the time to decide that would be at the new trial. It would not be at a revocation hearing on his probation. I don't think there's any problem. The condition of his probation was to attend and abide by the rules of treatment and successfully complete the treatment. Whether any speculative new trial, and in this case it was, I think, to call it remote would be generous at the specter of a new trial. The time to decide whether that would come in would be at a new trial. And I would argue, just on its face, if he signs that at that time saying I'm a sex offender and his plea, he's able to withdraw that plea, that form doesn't come in because he signed it pursuant to the situation he was in at the time. With respect to the argument that there was no willful violation of probation here, Judge Gabriel, I think you're right. That only applies to the ability to pay. It does not apply to other probation conditions. And even if it did, I think I'm not sure it can be disputed that this wasn't willful. And I'm not conceding that it needed to be. He showed up to probation. Regardless, the trial court's comments that he agreed to consent to probation was based on the fact that he had signed the conditions of probation saying that, yeah, I agree, I will show up there. The fact he then showed up at probation at the treatment and decided that he made the choice that he didn't want to participate in treatment. And the treatment provider made it clear, they read a letter, they made it clear that he intentionally decided not to completely fill out the paperwork. And with respect to the deniers, they make clear that this is that they do treat deniers for 90 days, and that this situation is different because, unlike in the situations we have provided sex offender treatment for, those clients have consented to become a client of therapy, which is an industry standard and requirement in general, not just an SOMB requirement for this kind of therapy. They also add, the clinical team finds that Mr. Banks' partial filling out of the form does not meet the letter or spirit of the concept of a client's consent for therapy, and therefore TAG cannot provide Mr. Banks with sex offender treatment because he's refusing this service. I think
so. Even the 90-day period they would refuse to provide on that basis, is that right?
Their position was, unlike the kid, we do provide deniers treatment. The people in deniers have consented to the treatment, and that's why we can do it. Here we have a situation where someone's refusing to become a client and we can't provide.
I'm confused. If they consent to treatment, they have to acknowledge they're a sex offender. and yet they're deniers. Help me with that.
I think that comes from just, as I explained shortly before, that the circumstance, they are sex offenders when they go to treatment. They can subsequently deny the crime that they committed once they get into treatment, but when they arrive at treatment, they are convicted sex offenders, and acknowledging that is acknowledging the circumstance they're in. It's not, I don't think, an admission, and there's no danger of self-incrimination in doing that. It's subsequently when they ask specifics about that crime that they deny those specifics when they're put in the deniers group.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I'd ask this court to affirm the court below. Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, I want to say him pleading guilty and him saying, I am a sex offender, is nowhere near admitting to a therapist the details of the instant offense. And that's exactly what they wanted him to do. And had he done that, admitted to the details, and then had he got a new trial on his 35C, which I believed he should have gotten, and I think he had a strong basis for that, they could have used that therapist and said, hey, tell us all the details that he told you about the instant offense. It's not just the guilty plea. It's not just saying, signing the form saying, I'm a sex offender. It's they wanted him to admit details and talk about details in the instant offense. And again, I want to get back to this. The probation complaint report said he refused to become a client. He didn't refuse to become a client. They refused him. They refused him. They didn't give him a use immunity, and the court even found, indeed, he consented to offense-specific treatment. By the words of their own complaint report, he did not violate probation. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.